Thank you, Chris, and Professor Stephen Martin and the trustees and management of CEDA, thank you for the opportunity to be here today in Adelaide. As you may know, we held the Reserve Bank's board meeting here yesterday, and we decided to continue our policy of stability, sometimes described as masterly inaction, and we've left the cash rate unchanged for just over a year now. The statement after the meeting described the reasoning, and so I won't go through that again. I was pleased to see that political events took the RBA rate decision off page one of the AFR. I've succeeded in my ambition to be boring. I hope I can continue that. What I'd like to do today is to make some broader remarks about the global and domestic economic and financial conditions. Well, the global economy has continued its expansion this year. Estimates for global growth right now are running at around 3.25%, up to perhaps 3.5% in some people's view, percent. That's a bit better than 2013. It's close to, albeit a little bit below, the long-run average, which is 3.6% over the last 30 years. We're now in September, so these estimates for 2013 should be pretty close to the mark unless something big happens in one of the large economies in the next little while. If you look at Australia's trading partner group, weighted by our exports shares, growth's running at, in fact, about 4.5%. That's actually a little bit above the 30-year average. It's interesting why that is. It reflects the continued increase in the weight of China in our export basket. China's actually growing more slowly than it used to. Its target for this year, which they seem to be achieving so far, is a mere 7.5% for real GDP growth. But the fact that its growth is much stronger than all our other trading partners and the fact that its weight in the export basket is going up pushes up the weighted average growth rate of that group of countries. Now, the determined pessimists in our country, of which there are many, will see the increased weight of China as a concern. What if something goes wrong in China? Won't we feel it? Which we would, of course. In fact, that's a question you could ask to many countries now. There are nearly 50 countries, 50 economies, for whom China is the number one or two trading partner. The full ramifications, actually, of China's continuing increase in economic weight and, I think, prospectively financial weight in the world is a topic from numerous lengthy books. But in short, the fact is that the whole world is more dependent on China than it once was and will feel more than it used to, whatever happens, good or bad, in China. For today, I think that probably the important thing to point out is that in China, the near-term task of the authorities is to manage a slowdown in credit growth and a decline in housing prices that's happening. This is something they sought to engineer, and it's not unprecedented that housing prices fell. This is the third time in the past 5 or 6 years, in fact, that Chinese housing prices have fallen. Yes, housing prices can fall, even in China. So this is a thing they need to manage. And so this area, the asset price credit nexus, I think is the part of the Chinese economy to watch, more so perhaps than the monthly PMI indexes or exports and the sorts of things that people traditionally pay a great deal of attention to. But one of the most remarkable features of the international scene right now, despite the fact that you could list a lot of things to worry about, one of the most remarkable things is how unworried financial market participants and the investor community seem to be about most of those things. Yields on sovereign debt for many countries are very, very low. In fact, they're the lowest recorded in many instances. Spreads on investment grade and financial corporate bonds have reached multi-year lows. Nowhere is this phenomenon more striking than in Europe. 2 years ago, major European countries were fighting an almost existential crisis of fiscal sustainability in the eyes of markets. Today, those governments are borrowing more cheaply than they were prior to the financial crisis in 2007. Some of them are actually borrowing more cheaply than they ever have before in their history. Corporate borrowing costs are similarly very low. Investment-grade bonds in the US and Australia, yielding not very much actually above the sovereign rate. Some entities have issued bonds with a maturity of 50 or even 100 years over the last year or so. Given the uncertainty about how the world will look in 50 years, it is strikingly low, the degree of compensation that investors are being given. Just as one metric of that, if you took the 30 stocks in the Dow Jones Industrial Average in 1964, 50 years ago, how many of those are still there in the same name doing the same thing today? It's about half. The others were merged, taken over, and in a few cases failed. So over a 50-year period, a lot happens. There's a strikingly low compensation for those risks being offered to investors right now. Another pricing puzzle is exchange rates. We've often talked in Australia, many people have talked about the higher level of the Australian dollar relative to the US dollar. The Reserve Bank's talked quite a bit about that, so I won't reiterate those points today. But it's interesting that many countries are having that conversation. It isn't just us. Many countries are wondering why their currencies are so high against the dollar. So really the question is why it is that the US dollar itself has remained as low as it has. So overall then, the global economy remains interesting, quote unquote, with significant challenges, uncertainties and puzzles. All that said, from Australia's point of view, the world economy is still growing. Globally, and I think here, inflation remains contained. Our terms of trade are falling, that is true, and they probably will fall further. But at this point, they actually remain remarkably high by historical standards. And financial conditions globally remain remarkably accommodative. On the domestic front, as Chris mentioned, we had the latest GDP data today. It was always expected that this quarter would be a slowdown from last quarter. The previous quarter was an exceptionally strong one, driven by some things which could not be repeated and have not been. If you take the two quarters together, you have a pace of growth which is actually pretty reasonable, getting to be close to trend, if not quite there yet. Now, there'll no doubt be a huge amount of breathless analysis of these data over the next 24 hours and what it all means. I think as that happens, it's worth taking a step back, remembering a longer-term perspective. And so in that spirit, let me offer an update of a graph that I showed here in Adelaide a couple of years ago that gives that longer-term one too far. I have to remember the lags on the button here. I seem to have lost one. Now, that's the bond yields that I was talking about. This is the one I want now. This is a measure of real GDP per capita since 2005 in a range of countries. Now, since I last showed this, and by the way, the Australia line here isn't up to date for today's figure. We didn't have time to do that. So with growth running just slightly ahead of population growth in the quarter, the red line will have inched up just a little bit more in the quarter, I think. Compared with last time I showed this here, it's pleasing that the US and the UK have recorded some solid growth at last. It's pleasing that New Zealand, which is actually one of our largest trading partners, has been growing particularly well as they get well involved in the rebuilding of their second largest city. Some of these countries have been growing faster than us lately. That they've sped up and maybe they're starting to close the gap, actually, well, we should welcome that. Even so, there's not much doubt, is there, about which country has had the most consistent performance out of this group. Worth remembering. Of course, these data are now up to the June quarter, and it's now September. So what's happening more recently? I think the answer to that is that growth in Australia continues. Most business surveys that we have suggest that business conditions have, if anything, improved just a little bit. And that household sentiment, which did seem to take a dip in April and May around the budget, that has recovered a fair bit of that fall over the past few months. And most of these sentiment measures actually are at average, or in the case of some of the business ones, a little bit above average. We have seen, as Chris said, the unemployment rate print higher in July. That was after several months in which it had not moved much at all. Now, there are some measurement issues which make it even more hazardous than it ordinarily is to interpret a monthly number. Nonetheless, we can't dismiss the data, and on their face, they were quite concerning. Other indicators, for what they're worth, have suggested, I think, I would say, a mild and gradual improvement in the labour market this year. I'm thinking of things like vacancies and measures of employment intentions in business surveys. They've, if anything, gone up. They certainly don't show the labour market deteriorating at an accelerating pace. So our reading, and we've had this reading for a while, is that the labour market has spare capacity. Unemployment is above the rate that we think we should be able to sustain in the long run, but it will be a while yet before we see unemployment come down in a sustainable way. Looking ahead, ideally, of course, the non-mining part of the economy would see a further pickup in growth, to be above trend for a while, because it's been below trend for some time up to now. And if we want to wind in the higher unemployment, we'd like to see non-mining activity grow faster than trend. We're not quite there yet, though I do think we are slowly building a foundation for that better performance. So what can the Reserve Bank do to help this? Well, the main thing we can do, and are doing, is run an accommodative monetary policy. And that lends support to aggregate demand in the non-mining parts of the economy. Rates of interest are at very low levels, and they've been there for over a year now. Most observers, and I'm not commenting on the future, obviously, but most observers expect that they will be there for some time yet. The rate that we actually set, the overnight cash rate, that almost no one actually borrows at, but it's the rate that others key off, that rate is as low as it's been in my lifetime, and it's been there for a year now. Rates of interest that matter more for actual borrowers have, in fact, declined a little bit over the years since we last changed the cash rate, and they are similarly very, very low by historical standards. They're lower than they were in previous cycles, even though the economy in aggregate is nothing like as weak as we've seen it in some of those other occasions. Of course, monetary policy doesn't just work on the borrowers. This is often forgotten. It also works on the saving side, and actually there are more savers than there are borrowers in the country. The low returns on offer on safe investments in Australia and the ultra-low returns at so many other places in the world are certainly having an effect by prompting investors to search for yield. Not only are returns on financial instruments low, but yields on the existing stock of physical assets, think of houses, commercial property, infrastructure assets, the yields on all these things are being bid down as we sit here by this search for yield. Some of that search, of course, is coming from outside our country because this search for yield is a global phenomenon. Well, that's a big part of how accommodative monetary policy works. It prompts substitution towards higher risk assets. It raises asset prices. That increases collateral value, and that makes credit growth more viable. It improves the cash flow of debtors and so on. All those things are quite normal parts of what economists refer to as the monetary transmission mechanism. In some ways, that term, monetary transmission mechanism, is something of a misnomer, because while part of this process is mechanical, a lot of it is not mechanical. It really depends on the behaviour and the general frame of mind of the myriad households, businesses, governments in the economy, and how they respond to the price of money. The final linkages in this monetary transmission mechanism, so-called, are the links that connect changes in financial behaviour, more financial risk-taking, to changes in spending on real goods and services, including investment goods, that is, entrepreneurial real economy risk-taking. And while high enough interest rates really can stop people spending if we're determined enough, it doesn't follow that really, really low rates make people borrow and spend. They have to want to do that. We can't make them do that. The power of monetary policy to boost demand in the economy depends importantly on one or more sectors in the economy being in a position to respond to very low interest costs, high collateral values, and so on, by spending more today with confidence that their income in the future will allow them to service and repay that debt in the future. So, really, for monetary policy to work powerfully, you're usually looking for some sector to think, yes, I'll take advantage of the cheap funding, I'll work my balance sheet harder, and I'll grow and spend. So which sectors would they be? Well, in the aggregate level, we can think of three. There's households, there's governments, and there's businesses. So let me talk a little bit about each of these. The willingness of households to borrow and spend, to leverage up their balance sheet, to grow their consumption spending ahead of income, was a striking feature of Australia's economic growth really from the early 90s up until about 2006. Consumption consistently outpaced income over that time. The ratio of debt to annual income for the household sector in aggregate went from 60% at the beginning to 150% by the end of that period. Now, households are servicing that debt quite well. Most of the debt's mortgages, the arrears rates on mortgages, it's about half a percentage point, so that's quite low by international standards. But as I have argued before, including in Adelaide, it seems unlikely that household debt and spending is going to behave like that again, starting from where we start today, and nor would it be desirable. So I think we can expect that households will grow their consumption in line with their income, maybe a little bit faster because we have had a rise in net wealth of a tangible size, a significant size over the past couple of years. But we're not going to see, I don't think, a return to the role of the consumer driving growth in the powerful way that it did in that earlier period. So what about governments? Will they gear up and spend? Well, most governments in Australia, of course, did expand their balance sheet, take on more debt during the phase of the financial crisis. Whatever you think of those policy responses, what governments, state and federal, are seeking to do now is to dampen the trajectory of their debt, to get budgets back towards surplus, to contain spending, and to strengthen their balance sheets rather than stretch them. Public final spending is scheduled, according to the stated intentions of state and federal governments, to be subdued over the next 2 or 3 years. In fact, it's forecast to record the most subdued growth over that period that we've seen for a very long time. So by and large, the public sector isn't really going to be gearing up its balance sheet in response to cheap funding in this period either. It's more inclined gradually to be in consolidation mode. So of the three sectors I mentioned, that leaves business. What can we say about it? Well, business is very diverse, of course. And so a general comment would not apply to many individual businesses, but in the broad, I think what we can observe is that the business sector's aggregate leverage is lower than it was a decade ago, and that's a contrast to households and governments. It seems that business holdings of cash have been increasing. You can look at that in a few places. The most striking place to do it is to take data that we have from the financial aggregates that the Reserve Bank compiles. And the left-hand panel here shows the level outstanding of what you might call business money. It's basically cash in the bank. And the green line is business borrowing from the financial system. The right-hand panel is the ratio of business credit to GDP. Well, the blue line here actually includes cash holdings of asset managers, so fund managers, and that's gone up about nearly $200 billion over this period. But even so, there's been a substantial increase, it would seem, in the amount of cash at the bank held by the business community over this last 5 years, and by substantial, we're talking in the hundreds of billions. And their leverage, measured here relative to GDP, but also measured in other ways, generally speaking, has gone down. So my conclusion would be that the liquidity of the business sector and its balance sheet has improved a lot over the past 5 years. I think it follows from that that businesses are in the position to play their role in the growth dynamic, to take advantage of lower funding costs, if they have the confidence to do so. The question, of course, is do they? And this comes back to that age-old issue of confidence, animal spirits, call it whatever you wish. Now, I think the fact that gross capital spending in the business sector outside of mining in a number of industries is barely above the depreciation rate of the capital stock, that tells me that at some point those investment spending intentions have to go up. It is the case that in the most recent forward estimates of stated intentions of business that came out last week, there was another upgrade in investment intentions for the non-mining business sector. It's still only showing moderate growth, and I think it would be good if over time we saw further and more substantial upgrades in those intentions, but they are heading in the right direction. Now, let me be clear that I'm not making some call for business leaders to step up and play their role in driving growth in the interests of the economy. That would be fruitless because that actually is not their job. Their job is to responsibly run their companies in the interests of the owners. My argument isn't that. My argument, simply put, is that at some point it's going to be in the interests of those owners for investment to take place in new technologies, better processes, new lines of business, new markets, and in time, more capacity and more employees. At some stage, I don't know when, the equity analysts, the shareholders, the fund managers, the various other commentators will want to be asking not quite so much where is your cost-cutting program or your capital return program, but more where is your growth program. As business responds to trends that foreshadow sustainable increases in demand and incomes, some of that response is going to come from smaller and newer players. It doesn't all come from the established players. Some of these smaller players will probably be amongst the most innovative enterprises that there are out there. There isn't much focus on what they're doing because it's hard to measure them, so there's not much focus on them. There isn't much general commentary about them in the news media. And that's probably because there are fewer established data sets on the smaller innovative sector than there are on the more established sectors. We know a lot about how many housing approvals were made every month. We know rather less about what's going on in the dynamic sector of smaller innovative companies. But my suspicion, based admittedly on some rather indirect measurement, is that innovation activity and risk-taking is actually occurring. You can appeal to a few different things here. There is a regular ABS survey for what that's worth on innovation in companies, and the trend here over the years is it's up and down, but basically the trend where businesses answer, yes, I'm developing innovations, that's going up, and there isn't an upward trend in businesses abandoning innovations. If anything, possibly that's gently trending down. I could also observe, as I have on other occasions, that for all the talk of productivity growth being poor, and it was for some time, there is productivity growth improvement starting to occur in the last place it does show, which is in the official data. It takes a long time, given the difficulty of compiling those data, for productivity trends to show up there. But in my opinion, there is something of a firmer trend in productivity growth now occurring. That needs to continue and get stronger, but it is beginning to happen. So that tells me, I think, that changes to processes and practices and enterprises and workplaces around the country is actually occurring. One crude gauge of animal spirits, so-called, that you might look at is the number of new company registrations with ASIC. You can get data on that. And as it turns out, the number of new companies being registered has risen by about a third since 2010. Now, there's no doubt many reasons that people register companies, but surely among them is going to be there are people with ideas, ambition, passion, plans, and they're saying, I'm going to have a go. So I think all of these things are at least encouraging. I think they're encouraging if you're looking for some evidence that there is some genuine risk-taking happening and starting to build up out there. And of course, in the end, that's really the vital ingredient for private sector growth. I talked a little earlier about what monetary policy can do to help. I need to be clear on what it can't do and also on what it shouldn't do. Monetary policy can create conditions of easier funding. It can help the financial sector in its ability to extend credit. But monetary policy can't, for example, add to the supply of land zoned for housing. It can't improve the responsiveness of the construction sector to stronger demand. Other policies have to do that. And actually, it's very important that they do it. If we're to see easy credit result in more dwellings, as opposed to just higher prices for the existing dwellings. Monetary policy can't create the additional infrastructure that most people agree that we need. In fact, funding conditions aren't really the problem for infrastructure. There's plenty of funding for good infrastructure projects. The real issues in infrastructure are governance, project selection, risk sharing, and pricing. They're areas that other policies have to get right. Monetary policy can't cause, in any direct way, the innovation and technological change that we would all agree is so important for the future well-being of our country. Other policy areas have to be right, and then the innovators, the risk takers and their backers have to be prepared to take the necessary risks. As for things that monetary policy ought to avoid, well, we're very cognizant when we make our decisions that policy does work initially by affecting financial risk-taking behaviour. In our efforts to stimulate growth in the real economy, we don't want to foster too much build-up of risk in the financial sector such that people or financial institutions become overextended. That could leave the economy exposed to nasty shocks in the future. So the more prudent approach is to avoid, so far as we possibly can, that particular boom-bust cycle that's proven to be so damaging over time. It perhaps is stating the obvious at present that while we may desire to see a faster reduction in the rate of unemployment, further inflating an already elevated level of housing prices seems an unwise route to try to achieve that. Well, in conclusion, The future, as ever, has no shortage of challenges. That's hardly new. Sensible policies in many areas are needed to help with the required adjustments. That includes those hardly limited to monetary policy within the limits of its powers. A very accommodative rate structure and a degree of stability and predictability has been in place for some time now. As I mentioned earlier, perhaps the conduct of monetary policy could be described as boring. If so, I regard that as a success. It may be true that financial markets like to think about almost nothing else than what will happen to the cash rate next month. But I suspect most people are happy not to have to think about that and prefer to focus on issues of more enduring importance to their businesses and their lives. And it's those things, actually, not interest rates, that, well attended to, will deliver our future prosperity and well-being. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Glenn. It's certainly not for an accountant to tell an economist that he's boring, so I won't do that. So who would like to ask the first question?
This is Con Michalakis. I'm head of investments at Statewide Super. You've got a world at the moment where the Europeans need quantitative easing, perhaps. The US is looking at getting away from zero interest rates. Where does that leave you trying to manage monetary policy across that domain?
Before I answer that, I should say that there is the joke that economists are the ones who lack the personality to become accountants. It is a complex world, as you say, and I think it's true that if things proceed according to the presently understood schedule from what the Fed has said, what the ECB has said, and actually also what Bank of Japan has said, it seems likely that the Fed will be on the road back to normal sometime, starting down that very long road next year. I think it's likely that the ECB is a very long way from doing that, and as you say, there's speculation of further balance sheet measures, as there could well be in Japan. So the big three jurisdictions are actually on separate tracks. This is in part why people have puzzled about the US dollar. And I think it's probably the case that many market players have lost money on that trade this year, waiting for it to rise. So that is a complexity. One could wish the world was much simpler. Oh, please, could that happen? But that's the complexity we have to live with. I think what we're trying to do, and this has been my view all along, we have to calibrate to some extent for the international setting that we face. But so far as we possibly can, we are trying to offer what I would call a normal service monetary policy. That is, there aren't balance sheet measures. We did do that briefly in 2009, just for a few months at the heat of the crisis, but quickly unwound. Since then, balance sheet's normal. Interest rates are positive. They're low, but they go up and down in response to what the framework dictates. It's normal service, and I very much hope that we can sustain that for a sufficiently long time to see normal service return in other countries.
Thank you. Eric Neal, retired engineer. Governor, we've been used in the past years to seeing growth rates from China in the 7, 8, 9% area. As the Chinese economy grows, would there not be an expectation that the percentage increases will diminish each year? Could you comment upon that?
We actually saw China grow at about 10%, roughly, on average for 10 years. Nobody grows that fast indefinitely, not even China. And they themselves have articulated the objective of around 7.5% in the near term, which they seem to be achieving. It's worth noting that China today, growing at 7, adds as much to global demand as China growing at 10 did 10 years ago because they're so much bigger than they were. I think it is true that into the future we will see the Chinese growth rate gradually diminish, not necessarily every year, but 5 years from now, it will be surprising if they're still growing at 7. It will be more like 5 or 6 or something like that. That's because there's a massive catch-up, but as you get closer to the point where you've caught up, you start slowing down. And, of course, their labour force won't be growing. They're probably about now at the point where population is about to peak, start to decline. This is a legacy of the one-child policy and so on. And so there's still a rise in productivity they can get by moving a lot of people from the farm to manufacturing or services, but the sheer growth in population of working age is going to slow down. For a bunch of reasons, their potential growth rate in the future won't be the same as it's been. But still, let's say they grew at 5. It's a very big economy. That's still a powerful force in the world and still something that we'll need to pay very close attention to.
Governor, one of the things that presumably affords comfort to the bank in relation to inflation is the slow growth of wages, which is a phenomenon that contrasts with what you read in the press almost every day about the outrageous demands that are being made and met. Does the bank have a view about the reason for this seemingly surprisingly low rate of growth of pay?
We do. I think, firstly, it is correct, as you say, that the rate of growth of labour costs is unusually low right now. It's running at about 2.5% a year on the best index we have for that. That's lower than average and lower than experience in the past decade or more. Why is that happening? Well, I think the labour market has clearly softened. The unemployment rate was 5, now it's 6 point something. So in that sense, I think the labour market is behaving in a way that you would expect. There's cyclical slack. The rate of pay gains slows down. That, by the way, helps to preserve jobs because the price being responsive to demand helps preserve jobs compared to the alternative. But there's no doubt it's quite modest, and with improved productivity performance as well, as far as I can see, unit costs are not rising very much at all. That is a big part of why we say that we think inflation, notwithstanding that the most recent number was a high one, we think in the next couple of years we will be consistent with the 2 to 3% target, even if the exchange rate were a bit lower than it is today. So that behaviour of the labour market, at least directionally in the way you'd expect, is a big part of our story right now.
Peter Hollister from the State Department of Transport. You're talking about labour market and a number of those things, but baby boomer cycle going through Australia. Just wondering about the degree of challenges and opportunities that come out of the baby boomer cycle that we're experiencing.
Well, one's tempted to wax on. I am a baby boomer, so sort of in the second half of it. So I could tell some stories against us, but maybe the best thing to do is to suggest that I think the phenomenon of ageing is understood to be very important. That has fiscal effects, much of which comes through the health system, actually, rather than pensions. I think baby boomers, we tend to carry debt later in life than our parents did. we perhaps have been a little bit over keen on investment property as our retirement plan, and we might at some point be a little disappointed. And most of us have not really saved enough in our lifetime. So there are many issues there, but I think those ones are at least conceptually understood. Whether quantitatively we have them properly calibrated, I wouldn't be sure of that. So I think that's a very powerful force, and I think, I suppose, to generalise a little, demographics broadly, not just the baby boomers, but the Chinese population, the Japanese population, which is going to shrink massively, actually, in the next generation. Similar things, directionally at least, will happen in some countries in Europe. These things will be quite important. And there's not a lot of precedent in history that I know of for trying to understand how you get growth and dynamism in a country whose population is going down. But Japan, I think, is trying to find that answer. So I think these demographic things are probably much more important than we've tended to give them credence for in the past.
Bruno Bellon from the Commonwealth Bank. Thank you for your speech today, Governor. Just wanted to pick your brain in terms of period of stability. It's been a line that the Reserve Bank has run for a number of months now. You have recently mentioned that you would remove that comment, period of stability, long before there'd be a change in monetary policy. Now, today you've articulated a few sort of a few examples of risk-taking that's taking place in the Australian economy. You also have GDP, which isn't too far off long-term trend, and you've also got inflation close to the top of the 2-3% band. What else would you like to see before you remove that comment?
Well, I'm not going to replace a period of stability with period of instability. And I'm not going to, engage in a continual dialogue publicly about how the language might change. The point I made a month or two back was simply that this is a device that we've employed which has done what it was supposed to do, which basically was, when we stopped easing, to stop everybody immediately running to the other side of the ship and say, well, the tightening's soon. It wasn't going to be, and we wanted to be clear about that. At some point, before this language starts to box us in, I'd like to change it to something much more vague. And that will probably be something like, policy remains appropriate. But I'm not telling you even when I'm going to be in a position to do that. That's all I'm going to say on that one.
Governor, you've referred to the exchange rate being stubbornly high. I was just wondering what do you think of the... Just clarify what the key contributors you think are to it remaining stubbornly high, and when, if and when, there are levers that we can and should pull to adjust that.
I don't think I've used the word stubbornly, though others perhaps have. What I've said is it remains above... And I think this is pretty clear, above most normal metrics that you would use to gauge its long-run equilibrium value, it's above those. I think that's fairly clear. So why is that? I think the earlier question that went to the very unusual state of affairs globally is a big part of the answer. And by the way, I think, although people think that the relativity in cash rates is a big driver of the exchange rate, well, it will be partly a driver. But when you think about it, the whole universe of yield on offer on all manner of assets in this country is high by the standards of other countries. houses, commercial property, infrastructure assets, as well as debt instruments. All of those yields, most of which we do not control in the bank, remain quite attractive to foreign investors. And I think a lot of the capital that's coming to the country is chasing those assets, not just the overnight rate. So that's a feature of the world we live in, and one presumes that that is a major part of why the exchange rate remains, in your words, not mine, stubbornly high, but in my words, above its likely long-run equilibrium value. How long that will be the case, I don't know.